They sent the raid unit in on us. They stripped us naked, humiliated us twice. What I experienced is, once again, just a glimpse of what Palestinians have to go through.
Do you think it was racially motivated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 1,000%. The way I was treated compared to all other volunteers was not the same. And the punishment lasted throughout the whole captivity.
You said, of all the years that you spent as a Black American in the United States, you've never felt that much hate that you felt when you were in the Israeli prison.
It's really beyond words, the amount of hatred I felt.
All right, so I'm about to speak to Chris Smalls. This is a man who just a few years ago rose to national prominence in the U.S. for becoming the person who took on Amazon and won. Smalls is the co-founder and former president of the Amazon Labor Union. But most recently, Smalls decided to join the Handala Flotilla, which sailed towards Gaza in an attempt to break Israel's siege. Now, after Israeli forces intercepted the ship in international waters, Chris says he was singled out and assaulted in ways that other activists on board were not. And by the way, it's worth noting that Chris was the only Black person on that ship. He's back home in the US now, and after being beaten, arrested, and detained by Israeli forces, he's about to join us to share what happened and why he chose to go. Chris Smalls, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
No, absolutely. I think the first question is, to how are you? How's your health since you returned? How's everything been?
I'm getting better by the day, you know. Definitely recovering from going on the hunger strike. So I'm getting my appetite back a little bit day by day, and physically, you know, I lost a couple pounds. So I'm just trying to get my strength back, and also dealing with the scabies from the prison conditions. I'm dealing with that, but I've been to the doctor and I got my medication. So everything's looking good.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're recovering, but even before we get into everything that's happened, you know, one question that crossed my mind is, you know, what's an American labor activist, a huge labor activist like yourself, doing, putting themselves right in the middle of Israel's war in Gaza?
That's the focus, is to really shed light on the fact that labor unions in America specifically have been participating by shipping arms to Israel, you know, for the last 21 months. And also, as a U.S. citizen that's paying, you know, our taxpaying dollars are going towards this genocide. I wanted to shed awareness on that as well. And being a labor leader, it definitely doesn't mean that Palestinian lives are outside the scope of labor.
I'm sure you've had people tell you, like, Chris, you know what you're going into. You know that they're going to intercept the boat. You know you're not going to reach Gaza. You're not going to be able to deliver any of the aid that you had. So why do it?
Yeah, I mean, the goal was never to deliver the aid. You know, even if we was to make it to Gaza, we didn't have enough to feed everybody, of course, obviously. But the goal is to break the illegal siege that Israel has imposed for over two decades. You know, this has been happening before October 7th. And that was our goal, to send a strong message to Israel that we're never going to stop. And we're going to continue to send boat after boat, ship after ship, until the siege is broken. And even though the Madleen didn't make it, we didn't make it. We made it further than the Madleen, less than 60 miles. I was very optimistic. I really thought that we had a really good chance of making it with the momentum that we had and the support that we had behind the scenes. So me, I just thought about it from always an optimistic standpoint that we'll make it there. But I think what we did, shedding light on it and awareness, it reached millions of people that may not have been aware of what's going on.
Just on that note, Chris, this optimistic standpoint that you talk about, what would you have done had you reached Gaza shores, realistically?
Realistically, I probably would have cried first because I'm a big baby. But, to be honest with you, there was some folks that we been in contact with. So I'm pretty sure we had a rendezvous with them. We would deliver the aid, of course, immediately. And, once again, just continue to spread awareness on the situation that's going on there. You know, we haven't even really get a chance to fathom what the Palestinians are going through every day there, because Israel has this illegal blockade that doesn't allow, real-time camera crews or footage of what's actually going on in Gaza. So it would have been monumental, really, to the public eye for us to really shed light on what's happening over there.
I think I heard you say that you got the call to join the flotilla, 24 hours before?
Yeah, pretty much. I was already in contact with some of the people that was on the Madeleine. But of course, they've been swamped with media requests and things like that, trying to get their lives back together. So I just so happened to get in contact with Hueda 24 hours before I left. And it was like one of those decisions, either now or never. And I definitely didn't hesitate.
So you had 24 hours to basically make up your mind about putting your life at risk. And you had to tell your loved ones. I'm sure you spoke with your kids too, with your children.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's all I actually, the only people I spoke to at the time was my children. They happened to be with me in the moment. So I had a conversation with them, you know, not too much to worry them, but to make sure that they know that I love them very much.
How old are they, Chris, if I can ask?
My twins are 13 and my oldest is 15.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're at the age where they understand what's going on. They're at the age where they have access to social media.
Social media, sure. Yeah.
You know, I had to explain them what I was doing. And, you know, they supported me 100%. And, you know, I'm glad that I was able to return home to them.
I'm sure they asked you some questions before you went off. Or did they ask you any questions?
Yeah, they asked me a few questions. It was just, you know, where are you going type questions. But, once again, I didn't want to scare them too much. I didn't want them to have the thought that their dad is going to, you know, not return home. So I kept it really, really vague with them. But they definitely were paying attention on social media for sure.
And those are, you said it was only the children that you spoke to. You hadn't spoken to anyone else around you about this.
No, I didn't even have a chance to tell my mom. I didn't have a chance.
Wow.
Pretty much anybody.
No. Really? So you didn't tell your mother about this?
No, not really, no. No, not even my mom got the chance to have the conversation. She would have tried to encourage me not to go anyway, but for good reason, I definitely didn't tell her.
She
still was the first person at the airport waiting for me, so she knew.
When did she find out? Did you find out when you were on the boat?
Yeah, you know, we had the first leg from Syracuse to Gallipoli, so that was like 2 days of sailing. So she found out when I was in Italy, pretty much already preparing to set sail. And yeah, there was nothing she could do. She knew that she couldn't change my mind anyway, but I had to tell her when I got to Italy for sure.
Right. What was the first thing she told you?
You know, it's more of like, you know, why are you doing this? Or,
right.
You know, why it has to be you? Or, you know, you could have done it in different ways. Advocate in different ways like you always do. But I told her, you know, I've done plenty of rallies, protests in New York City. I've done things around the country, around the world. I've been to several different encampments already. I've been to several different parliaments already, you know. So the advocacy is just one thing, but I already know from my organizing against Amazon that direct action is always the best action.
Direct. So you felt you had to take it up a notch. You felt you had to take your protests and raising awareness up a few levels.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think the time is now. And once again, as a labor leader from America, I felt that this will help push the narrative and also apply pressure on other labor unions and union activists to get involved.
Okay, so if we go to the story of what happened when you did get on and you started the sailing, you started the ship's journey, I think there was 21 activists on board, right? There was 7 Americans, you were one of them. And then what was the situation like? You said you were the one doing the night shift. I mean, what responsibility did that entail, having the night shift on?
Yeah, so every day we had different chores, whether it was cleaning up the deck or cleaning the kitchen, washing dishes, the bathrooms. We are rotating in and out, you know, the different chores throughout the day. I was really limited because I get seasick a lot. So I had to limit myself to certain tasks, but I'm a night owl. I stay up all night. People know that, you know, I hardly sleep anyway. So the night shift was something that I would always pretty much sign up for if I had an opportunity. And yeah, you know, prior to interception, I did like the the few nights before, like I want to say by 2 or 3 nights in a row, I was paying attention to the increased drone activity as we were getting closer to Gaza. So
can you describe the scene for me, Chris? So like there were just drones that were kind of flying over, hovering over the boat, or what was it like?
Yeah, they weren't hovering over the boat until the day of interception. But prior to that, they were just flying over very frequently, and they would come from the north to the south or east to west, different directions. And they would come every 10 to 15 minutes. You know, they were right back to back. And as we got closer to Gaza, the amount of drones increased heavily. You know, it went from just seeing a few a night to maybe a couple, like double digits. But now we're talking about 40 to 50 drones per night. And that's just in like a 4-hour window. So I knew that they were really heavily surveilling us and keeping track on the boat speed and data that they were collecting.
Were you able to figure out if it was just Israeli drones or if it was other countries that were sending their own drones as well?
Oh, definitely was other countries. We identified a few of them. Not all of them were easily to be identified, but some of them came from Greece. Some of them came from Egypt. In other countries that were along the Mediterranean as well.
How could you tell? How could you tell which countries they belong to?
We have a land team, and our land team has some type of, I don't know if it's an app or a website or something, where they're able to take the picture and compare it to other drones in a database.
In a database, okay. And they were basically telling you, oh, these drones belong to these countries.
They were, and whether they are a threat or not. And most of them weren't really a threat. They were really Coast Guard drones looking for refugees and things like that.
Did at any point the drones get threatening?
Well, of course, the night of interception, the drones definitely were a military operation. They weren't the ones that we were discovering. A lot of them we couldn't identify. And those are the ones that were unmarked, unidentified, even the vessels in the water. Every vessel in the water has to have some type of identification. But the night of, there were several unidentified vessels that were trailing us or chasing us or tracking us, and some are coming in our direction. So we knew it was a military operation. And I could tell you from my experience, what I've seen with my eyes, the drones were dropping some type of smoke grenades or smoke flares from the sky down to block our visibility. And I think that was also a military tactic that they were using with the drones.
Before I get to the night of the interception and when the Israeli soldiers came on board, there's something I heard you talk about, and I this is something I want to kind of stop at and try to understand as much as I could. You said that there was an attempt to sabotage the journey, right? And at some point there was a delivery of acid that was supposed to get into, I guess, the water tank or something like that.
Yeah. In Gallipoli, Italy, before we were setting sail on our second leg of the trip, we had to obviously refill our tank of water in the boat. This is our shower water. This is our cooking water. We were expected to have a tank of fresh water delivered to the boat the day of, and instead we received a tank of acid, sulfuric acid, and thankfully one of our crew members spotted it out right before it was being pumped into our boat, which delayed our sailing, and some of it even splashed on one of our crew members' leg, which caused a little bit of burning. So we knew that it wasn't fresh water right away.
Wait, so this acid tank or this acid barrel, whatever it was, the container, it was shipped to you?
Yeah, it was delivered to us.
It was delivered?
Yeah. I just randomly delivered this acid tank instead of fresh water. And once again, right before it was being pumped into our boat, that's when we noticed the label on it.
Right. So it was supposed to be a freshwater delivery, but instead it was acid from what you've seen. But I guess the question here is, once you figured out that it's acid, obviously this is an attempt to heavily injure, even maybe result in the killing of members on board. So were there any attempts to, I guess, speak to the police or to raise some sort of case or something about this, or what happened after that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, we didn't want to raise too much awareness on it right then and there, because it would have delayed our sailing. It would have been a whole investigation. They probably wouldn't have let us leave the port of Gallipoli, which would have delayed us a few more days. So we didn't want to do it until we were already into international waters. But we did file a formal complaint with the Gallipoli Police Department. And there is still pending an investigation of what happened there. That's all I know for right now. But I do know that we didn't want to do it while we were docked at the port, because it could have delayed us even further. But it did delay us 2 hours. We were delivered a fresh tank of water afterwards. That's still a pending investigation. And we hopefully they get to the bottom of it. But if we had to take a really educated guess of who sent that, Israel did put out an announcement a week prior saying that they would do anything in their power to stop the Hundella from leaving the port of Italy.
So you're drawing that connection based on that statement?
Yeah, I mean, well, of course. And not only that, our rotor was also tied down that morning as well. So, you know, these two coincidences don't just happen randomly. The way the rotor was tied, it was definitely tied in a way to hinder the boat from leaving. The type of rope that was used was nylon, which is really heavy rope. And then the same morning, a tank of acid being delivered, just doesn't add up.
Did you get a chance to speak or see the person who delivered that acid container?
Other members did. Other crew members saw who the person was. We had pictures of him. We took some pictures. So,
and I'm assuming this was given to the police as well.
Yeah. Yeah. All the evidence we had was given to them.
If we go back to the night of the interception, so what happened? I mean, we saw a video, but then it quickly cuts off. And we've seen similar videos with previous flotillas as well, where basically all the crew members or the activists on board, they kind of sit, they raise their hands, and then the soldiers come on. And then I guess the camera footage just cuts off right after that. It was very similar from what we saw on the Hundella, which you were on. But tell me from your experience what you saw, how'd they come in, what happened?
Yeah, once again, yeah, you're right. They come on, they cut communications right away. They don't want the world to see, obviously. They always like to come in the middle of the night. They don't come when the sun is up. With the Madeline, they came at 3 a.m. With us, they came around 11 p.m. They come on board in groups, sometimes 10 to 12 at a time. Multiple ships. I think there was at least, I don't know, I counted at least maybe a dozen ships that were surrounding us. And pretty much they just have us all on deck with our hands up. And we had to remain on deck pretty much in place until they transfer us over to the port of immigration, which took us about 12 hours of sailing with them throughout the night.
12 hours sailing with them to get to the port.
Yeah.
And when did you get assaulted? Because there was a series of events that happened, and I'm trying to figure out how they went chronologically. So at first, I guess from what we've seen with the Madeline, the previous one, there were obviously a bunch of photo ops. They were giving out sandwiches, I think, to the members on board. I think Greta Thunberg was one of the ones pictured being given a sandwich or something. And then that became a whole discussion on Twitter. But you were saying that basically when the photo ops or when the cameras came out, you were covering your face. Was that right when they came on, or was this as you guys were about to sail to the port?
Right. So they couldn't use the propaganda that they did with the Madeline on us. They already knew that we were on a hunger strike. We announced it a day prior. So it killed all their propaganda about the sandwiches and water. They wanted to give it to us. They tried throughout the night. It didn't work with any of us. We all refused. But when they transferred us in the morning to the port of immigration, that's when there was even more cameras at the docks waiting for us to get off. And that's when They called us off one by one by country. The Americans was left for last. I was one of the last to get off the boat. And yeah, I covered my face and I gave them a piece of my mind, especially the IOF soldiers. I told them, you know, without our taxpaying dollars, you guys are nothing. Nothing but, you know, killing.
You said this to them?
Yeah, I said it to them directly to the IOF. Not to the Port of Immigration, but to the IOF as I was exiting the boat. But then when the Port Authorities came, they had camera crews as well. And I put my hands up, told them I didn't consent to any of these photos. And, you know, once again, they that's when they called over the seven authorities and tackled me to the ground and violently assaulted me. And then isolated me from the rest of the crew.
And it's important to note here, Chris, that you were the only Black person on board, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I was the only Black African-American on board. We did have an Arab brother, Hatem, mm-hmm. from Tunisia as well.
Here's what they're saying. And it's not an attempt for me to tell you, oh, you have to respond. But they're saying you're the only one that resisted. And that's why you got assaulted and you got kicked and all that jazz, basically.
That's a joke. I mean, honestly, I had no reason to resist. Resist what? You know, we already announced we were on the hunger strike. The propaganda that they tried to do with the sandwiches wasn't going to work. The only thing that I didn't consent to was the photos that were being taken, trying to change the narrative. And I didn't have to resist in anything. I encouraged them, and my response is to release the footage. And that's something that we haven't seen. Like we saw with the Madeleine, there was plenty of propaganda coming from them. They were eager to release photos and pictures of sandwiches and water and call us a selfie yacht. With the Hadnulla, they haven't done any of that. It's just a statement. And I encourage them to release whatever footage that they have. And I guarantee if they ever did that, it will be shocking and jaw-dropping from the images that people would see.
So then why would they assault you? Do you think it was racially motivated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 1,000%.
No doubt, huh?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt in my mind it was racially motivated. The way I was treated compared to all other volunteers was not the same. And the punishment lasted throughout the whole captivity. It was by design that I was to leave last, you know, on the fifth day instead of the sooner, like the rest of my comrades who left. You know, they made sure that they wanted to punish me, not just physically, but also psychologically as well.
Psychologically? Because even physically, from how you described it, it was awful. You said they tried to use your jewelry as a noose, basically to choke you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, three on each side. One was pulling my hair back and using my chains to choke me as well. And he was telling me to shut up repeatedly, even though I was telling him I couldn't breathe. They didn't care, you know, and they slammed me on the floor a few times. And then when they picked me up, they took me into a separate room. They threw me against the wall face first. And they were whispering some racist remarks in my ear saying that, you know, we're the furthest thing from your brothers. And, you know, if you say anything or do anything, I'm going to throw you back on the ground. And they guarded me heavily with five guards the entire time. I was isolated and I was heavily guarded.
Did they throw around any racial slurs as well, or was it just that remark?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't understand Hebrew at all, but I can tell you from the tone of their voices, the looks on their faces, they were saying some very disgusting things about me and also about the rest of the passengers. They kept looking through the door, looking at them in the other room, and, you know, they were making jokes and laughing. And just, you know, I could just tell by the energy that it was very dark and nasty.
In that moment, Chris, I mean, I know obviously you, surely before you went on and as you were on this trip, you were prepared for the worst, right? And I'm sure you knew that this also could have had a risk on your life. But when all of this was happening, the kicking, the beating, the isolation, singling you out as you're telling me the story right now, I guess, did any of this kind of catch you by surprise? Did you feel like you were prepped for, obviously not prepped for a moment like this, but did it come as a shock to you is what I'm trying to get at?
No, not really. I mean, what I experienced is, once again, just a glimpse of what Palestinians have to go through, you know, and that's what I was thinking about, you know, like this is nothing compared to what Palestinians have to go through. And it's unfortunate that I even have to experience it. But I told my crew in several meetings, you know, prior to us being intercepted, that if anything happens to me, I don't want them to try to risk their lives by standing up for me, because I know what I signed up for. And the world needs to know the truth.
And then what happened? So did they, after you got to the port, after you experienced all of what you just told me, did they put you in a cell? I mean, what was the situation after that?
Yeah, we had to be processed in, whether we wanted to be self-deported or whether we wanted to see the judge. I obviously wanted to see the judge.
Okay. So you asked for basically a judicial process.
Yeah, but once you do that, now you're being transferred to the prison authorities. And that was a whole nother episode. Pretty much they hand you over to the prison authorities right away. And that's when things got a little bit more violent. They started throwing half our wardrobe away. They threw away everything pro-Palestine. They threw away my keffiyehs. They stole some of my items right in front of me. And they basically told me, like, you're not going home, you're going to prison. So they threw me right in the back of the paddy wagon van. And that I had to sit there for about an hour and a half before we were driven to prison.
And then what happened when you got there? They put you in a, like, solitary confinement? Did they put you with others?
Yeah, so once we got processed in prison, it was seven of us in one cell.
Seven?
Yeah, seven in one cell. The room had about eight bunks. So eight beds, but it was seven of us. And that's really unheard of when you have seven people in one room. It's too hot. The rooms are poor oxygen. And they had two in another room right next to us. But we were isolated from the other prisoners. They put a curtain up to make sure the other prisoners couldn't see or interact with us at all. The entire time we were subjected to solitary confinement. We were on 24-hour lockdown because of the hunger strike. They punished us. They didn't allow us to have any yard time, any outside communication. We only had to see the lawyer twice. And they pretty much, they weaponized food against us. Once again, they tried to psychologically break us down by continuing to offer us food, knowing that we couldn't take it or we wasn't going to take it.
Do you think it was a way to taunt you almost?
Absolutely. Yeah. They had the warden come in one day, and the warden would literally sit a loaf of bread right in front of us on the table, sit a hot meal on the table and tell us, you know, do you want to eat? Do you want to eat? And we're telling them, like, we're on a hunger strike. You guys know this. Just give us water. That's all we wanted. And we don't know what type of water we were drinking, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't clean water. And, that was our only way that we really could survive, was just drinking water and keeping our morale and spirits up.
And what was happening to you during this time? I mean, were you getting sick? What was happening to your body physically?
Yeah, it's hard to explain. I mean, I was definitely sick, not from not eating, but land sickness from being on the boat, being on the water was a thing. So a lot of hallucination, you know, just from that. I already disassociated myself, knowing the conditions that we were in. And yeah, you know, the fact that, we had to deal with bed bugs every night, waking up in the middle of the night, trying to
bed bugs.
Yeah. I had bed bugs the first night. I found some, and then I caught scabies, you know, aftermath was another thing. But they also raided us twice. You know, they sent the raid unit in on us. They stripped us naked, humiliated us twice for no reason, knowing that we didn't have anything. So I knew once again, they were trying to psychologically break us down more than physically.
And were they communicating with you at all during this period, the Israeli soldiers or the Israeli police units? Like, were they telling you why they were doing what they were doing? Or was it just like straight up just a raid? You know, open the door, come in and strip you naked, as you said.
Yeah.
Without any kind of communication.
No, you know, we just tried to be on our P's and Q's and pay attention. And once we saw the raid unit coming, we knew that they were coming straight for us. They didn't go to any other cell but ours. And that was one thing that I noticed. They did it 2 days in a row. They raided us back to back.
So you were being specifically targeted, your cell, basically.
Absolutely.
And amid all this, Chris, did you ask to speak to the American consulate? Did you ask to speak to the U.S. Embassy in Israel? Like, yeah, what was that situation like?
Of course. You know, I did. I asked for my rights, you know, to speak to the U.S. Embassy, consulate, even our lawyers. They didn't allow my lawyer in. I only saw her one time. They didn't allow her in the other days.
And if I'm not mistaken, the lawyers that you had were Palestinian citizens of Israel, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the embassy never showed up, the U.S. embassy. Every other country showed up except for the U.S., basically, which is a shame.
How'd that make you feel? I know you're saying it's a shame, but how'd you feel in that moment when you couldn't even reach the consulate or the embassy?
You know, honestly, I expected that too, you know. The U.S. is complicit with the genocide. This Trump administration already invited the war criminal to the White House several times. So I wasn't expecting much justice from the U.S. Embassy at all. You know, I just was relying on the lawyers that we had and relying on the system that, you know, that the apartheid system, if you want to call it, to do what they do, rubber stamp us to be deported.
So what work were the lawyers doing during that period?
The lawyers did an excellent job representing our cases. When we saw the judge, they brought up the violence that was that I was subjected to. They pretty much brought on a strong case about our intent to go to Gaza, not Israel. We were illegally kidnapped. They used the International Court of Justice, a law. They used the fact that we were set sail to go to Egypt and dock for the night on a public channel, which Israel had access to. They knew that we, even the night of interception, that we were trying to go to Egypt to dock for the night, which was only 26 miles away. So we had a really good, strong case against them, you know. But once again, dealing with that system, they were just going to rubber stamp us to get out of there.
And what happened to get you out? How'd you get out eventually?
Well, honestly, I'm not even too sure because we were told that we were going to be notified about the judgment. We never was. I just knew that they were sending people home in groups prior after we saw the judge. From Monday on, people started going home, you know, 3, 4, 5 at a time.
And then you, from there, you went to like the day that you left, you were basically, were you sent to Jordan first and then you went to the U.S. from Jordan? Or how did it go?
No, once again, it was no information given to us. Me and Hatem pretty much had to figure it out. They literally put us in
the last two people of color, basically, you and Hatem.
Yeah, yes. And we were in the back of the van for about an hour and we're like trying to figure out what airport we're going to. We were so confused. And when we found out that we were being dropped off at the border, it was when we basically arrived to the border of Jordan. And they just gave us $300, told us to take a taxi to the airport. They left us there. Thankfully, Hatem's embassy came and picked him up. And thankfully, I was able to use some Palestinian brothers that I found a cell phone to contact the Freedom Flotilla Coalition and let them know that I was at the border, and they sent somebody to meet me.
You know, Chris, you said something which to me kind of made me just look at this completely differently. It's such a strong statement. But you said, of all the years that you spent as a Black American in the United States, you've never felt that much hate that you felt in that week and a half or however long it's been when you were in the Israeli prison.
I stand by that. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's really beyond words. The amount of hatred I felt and, just the evilness of it's no remorse. It's really, just straight up. It's really bred in hatred. Like it's something that fuels them. It's something that is a part of their culture. And, you know, I've never experienced anything like that in my life here in America. And, Yeah, I mean, I don't see how Palestinians can live peacefully among any type of situation like that. I don't see it at all, not even close.
You know, we often hear activists and others in America talk about some parallels between the Black struggle in the United States and the plight of the Palestinians, basically. I don't know if these are dots that you are connecting, or you feel like, yes, there are things that are similar here from your experience.
No, absolutely. I mean, the treatment of Palestinians and the treatment of Black people, it correlates heavily. And not only that, the prison system that they have over there in Israel, even though they isolated us from the prisoners, we were able to walk through once or twice. And I noticed the amount of Africans and Ethiopians that they had locked up. And I've seen it for myself firsthand. And that's my experience. And you know, nobody can tell me otherwise. I went over there to see exactly what I saw, and I confirmed it, what we all been thinking this whole time.
I mean, yeah, and the Israeli government has long been accused of racism, not just against Palestinians, but also against African migrants who do end up there as well. But the reason why I asked you this question, so, you know, I had Ta-Nehisi Coates on the show several months back. And obviously, one of the things that he spoke about when he wrote his book, The Message, when he visited the occupied West Bank, is basically he was drawing connections between the Jim Crow South in the U.S. And what's happening in Israel-Palestine. Basically, he was saying that this is, in reference to Israel, that this is an apartheid state that's reminiscent of the Jim Crow South. Another person that I spoke to on the show was Jamal Bowman. And he was telling me from his experience as a politician, he was saying that he started seeing how AIPAC targets these grassroots organizations that work in Black communities in the U.S. to try to basically have some sort of influence on them. And so amidst all this, I think I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if it's too early for me to ask this question, but what has this experience taught you about not just the American-Israeli relationship, but also what happens on the ground?
What happens on the ground when it comes to Palestinian liberation, a lot of people got involved, I want to say, right after October 7th. A lot of people, it took some time to even convince them to even say the word ceasefire. A lot of people still to this day don't want to admit or want to ignore what's going on over there. And for me, as an African-American, it was a no-brainer that this fight was absolutely a part of every struggle that I've been fighting for ever since I've been in the public eye. And when I was privileged enough to get my passport just a few years ago, and I was able to leave the country, I learned so much just from leaving the country. So for me, I was in Berlin during the week of October 7th. One of the largest Palestinian communities outside of Palestine, 40,000 of them reside there. And what I've seen with my own experience on the ground, as Palestinian children were dragged away from their parents right in front of me as an American, when I came back home to the U.S., there was no way I was going to be silent about that, be complicit. As a labor leader, as just a human being, as a father, all of the above, I spoke about it day one. And I lost tens of thousands of followers. I lost opportunities that people wouldn't even imagine, whether it was financial or whether it was job opportunities, whatever. You name it, I lost. And that's when I realized the sacrifice that you have to speak up about oppression, then it must be done. You know, the same thing that happened at Amazon. When I spoke out, I was fired. I was targeted. Jeff Bezos signed off on racist remarks. It just reminded me that the system was never built for any of us, especially people of color. And once again, the Palestinian people deserve the same liberation as any other civilian on the planet. And that's what we're fighting for. It's a class war. And connecting all of these dots and all of these entities is something that we must do.
And even on that note about connecting the dots, I think one of the core issues of this is that a lot of people in the U.S. still see this as a foreign policy issue instead of looking at it as a domestic issue, right? Because it's taxpayer money that funds what Israel is doing, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's been something I've been saying. If we're Americans, we need to be outraged of what we're doing right now with our taxpayer money. Same thing, these labor unions shipping arms to Israel, the blood is on their hands too. Corporations like Amazon, Google, Meta, the investments, a $7.2 billion project Nimbus, it's all connected. They are the Iron Dome. They are the military industrial complex. And it's all related. Whether you're a unionist or non-union, you're part of the working class, and we all have to have a role in this struggle.
Well, okay, let me ask you this, because you talked about you being in the public eye. When you did rise to national fame in the U.S., you know, you got all these accolades, right? You were on the Time 100 list. You were on the cover of, like, New York Magazine. You were interviewed by the biggest shows in the country. I'm curious to get your thoughts on basically do we call it silence on how the media reacted to what happened to you? Because you were barely on any American headlines. But let's talk about that first, because I'm also going to jump to the politicians, but let's deal with the media attention.
Well, yeah, the media is complicit. You know, I was, I don't know how many times I've been in the New York Times. I lost count. When I was an Amazon worker, a fired Amazon worker, headlines gravitated to me, pretty easily. Whether I was, protesting in front of Jeff Bezos' house or starting a union. And even when we won and made history, American history, to see the media be complicit, and not only complicit, but just put out misinformation over the years, it's been very eye-opening. But I knew that prior to even joining the Handela that they're not going to cover this mission the way they covered the mission with Greta Thunberg, who's like a worldwide climate activist, and we already know a very pro-Palestine now. And I saw that. I saw how they flipped on her. I said, I felt that, because that's the same thing that happened to me as well. Once I started speaking up about pro-Palestine.
You see them as flipping on you.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I have access. I have a whole Rolodex full of journalists. I can text them right away on their cell phones right away, but they won't even dare touch any of these stories because their editors or their bosses was not going to publish it. You know, and I see how emails come in even after I returned home. You know, I made it on ABC News, and then I got contacted by some other big names. I won't name them now, but basically, they started to backtrack, you know, oh, yeah, well, we have to keep things going. Or, you know, the media, the narrative is already changing. So they're only there for a moment. And I always say this as an organizer to the people on the left. We have to create our own propaganda. We don't have to rely on mainstream media at all, or legacy media. It's up to the people to tell the truth. And that's what got me here, speaking truth to power. And I'm going to continue to do that no matter what platform.
And what about politicians? I mean, back then, we've also seen you pictured with the biggest politicians in America, right? Like Bernie Sanders, AOC. I mean, at some point, you met Joe Biden as well. And I think the only politician that I saw speak about you was Summer Lee. I haven't seen anybody else speak out. But again, how do you react to that? Or what does that tell you?
It's not even enough for me to react to it. It's up to the other people, the people around me, the people in the community to react to it. I put out my statement on Twitter. I say, you know, everybody that was silent, I see every last one of you. And they know who they are. There's no way you can't tell me that these politicians didn't catch wind of what was going on, especially with me or any of the missions. I'm pretty sure they're aware of what's going on. And they chose to be silent. It was a choice. They could either do what Summer Lee did, or they could be silent and ignore it. And they chose their side. So I hope for people who were paying attention to that, call it out. Call it out until you can't anymore, because these are the ones, are the same ones that the scream that they're with the working class. They'll show up to my Amazon warehouse to take pictures with my union with no problem. But they don't do anything for us. And that's what we have to call out, is that when it comes time to push and shove, they're nowhere to be found. And they're more than complicit. They are participating in the genocide.
And what about labor unions? I also was surprised to find that not a lot of labor unions spoke out in your favor. I mean, even the head of the Teamsters union, Sean O'Brien, he was getting some heat. Well, some heat online, I should say, for not saying anything about what happened to you. And I say this because the Amazon labor union was recently affiliated with Teamsters, so there was a connection there. But again,
sorry, not affiliation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, how do you feel?
You know, it's disheartening, really, honestly. You know, it really sheds light on who these people are, you know, and not only that, who these labor unions are. And that's fine, you know. I was, once again, when we won and made American history, the ALU rejuvenated the labor movement, so to speak. That was their words. And everybody was excited to fly me all over the country. Everybody brought me in as keynote speakers or panelists or whatever you want to say. They used the story. They used the clout. And then they forgot all about the fact that the fight is still happening. So, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame that these labor unions have chosen a side. And it's obviously, once again, not with the working class. You know, they chose to be silent. They continue to have investments with Israel or shipping arms, manufacturing, or worse, they haven't passed any resolutions to voice their concerns or anything like that. And we have to, once again, as the people, we have to call it out every single time. There's no exception for that, no excuse.
You were saying that you see that the media is complicit. You see a lot of the politicians as complicit. Would you say that also a lot of these labor unions in America are complicit?
Yeah, 1,000%. 1,000%. There's no way you can see somebody as prominent as me in the labor movement and don't say anything. There's no way. It's impossible not to say nothing unless you just really don't care or you really are complicit. And the labor movement, you know, has a lot of different issues right now anyway. It's very divided and it's not as much solidarity as people think it is. And once again, we're talking about a labor union that's dying every day. Labor union density in America is less than 6% in the private sector, less than 10% in the public sector. It's a very small world. And that's really what's more shocking, because they have an opportunity to really talk to the younger generation. And the younger generation is so much smarter. They're paying attention to every little detail. And we learned this with the last presidential election. We don't care. There's no more vote blue no matter who. There's no more two-party system. They're trying to escape the two-party system. And the labor unions really need to wake up, because they're going to lose their entire base. And we're going to lose this battle against artificial intelligence and other powerful entities if we do not come together.
Can I ask you about how you see things from where you are right now? Because we're seeing outside of the U.S., we're basically seeing these polls, these reports that are saying that Americans are more and more looking unfavorably towards Israel. Right. And now I think it's the last one I saw was like 53% of Americans or something close to that have an unfavorable view of Israel. And then we're hearing, and you touch on this a little bit, but we are hearing this talk about, you know, there is a shift in the tides, there is a shift in the perceptions and in the views. But how are you seeing it from where you are?
Well, I could tell you that it's been that way for a very long time in the spaces that I be in, especially with the student movement. I could have said this 2 years ago. You know, there's no way if these politicians don't call it what it is, genocide, and don't speak up for Palestinian lives, they're not going to win any of their future electoral elections or anything like that. For me on the ground, I already seen it. You know, there's no way, you know, people can't tell me that they're not convinced that Israel is in the wrong here. And I do see that there is a slow, you know, America's very retroactive. You know, for some reason, we always have to wait till things get really, really bad before it gets better. And I think that's where we're at right now. We're in that time frame where it's so bad. More people are waking up. You know, more people are talking about it. More people are paying attention than ever before. And especially compared to last year and the year before, I can definitely feel that there is a shift on a broader level, more outside of the spaces that I be in. So yeah, there is a shift, but it's a slow one. You know, we're very, once again, the way we reacted to COVID, the way we react to any social justice or injustice, it's always a slow start, and then we finally get the picture. So I hopefully sooner than later, we're able to fully commit to the Palestinian liberation.
And now that you're back in the U.S., Chris, and hopefully when your health fully recovers soon, what do you feel your next steps are?
Oh, I mean, I'm right back in the streets where I always are. I'm always in some type of New York City action, for sure. I'm going to get back to work with my union, of course, trying to get a contract. That's always going to be a priority. And I'm supporting the next flotilla mission, whether it's behind the scenes. I'm always going to support the flotilla missions that are going to happen from here on out. And
just on that note, Chris, sorry to cut you off, but what the more I know that there are more flotillas being planned, and I know there's a lot more that they want to put out. But what do you feel the benefit of having these ships is, other than just a little bit of media attention here and there? But what do you think it's actually doing?
Oh, it's once again, shedding awareness. You know, a lot of people are still unfortunately sleep, you know, but at the wheel. They're really, there's still pockets of Americans. There's still places around the world, different countries where people are trying to live a normal life, and things are not normal right now. And I think these flotilla missions, the more countries are getting involved, the more people are getting involved. And depending on the type of activists that get involved in the future, politicians, whether it's MPs, it applies pressure in several different ways. And I think that that's always necessary. This has to be different lanes for people to have the activism continuing to happen. You know, I don't encourage everybody to do what I did. I even said this before, we shouldn't have to. We shouldn't have to put our lives on the line, but it's necessary. And I don't want my comrades to have to do what I've done and actually go through what I've been through. It's rare. It's not meant for everybody. And if you're not mentally strong, if you're not physically fit, it will break you down, the whole movement. So you have to understand this is a lifetime fight, and you have to fight in ways that you, in several different ways. The flotilla is just one way of doing it. And I'm going to support that. But also, prior to me joining the flotilla, I already was planning a U.S. delegation for labor to go to Jerusalem and do some humanitarian aid on the ground. We're working with some of the Palestinian organizations that I met with. And that's something that I may do in the future. You know, I got to check on my legal status, whether I'm banned from Israel or not. But I definitely will be back in some capacity over there and trying to help the people and help deliver some humanitarian aid.
And my last question for you, Chris, before I let you go, for Americans that are listening to you right now, what do you hope, or what message do you hope to get to them?
The same thing before, you know, we all should be outraged as Americans where our money is going. So many problems here at home that we need to deal with, from homeless crisis to social injustice to climate issues to housing issues, everything that you can imagine that's going on here. People living paycheck to paycheck. The fact that these labor unions are still a lot of infighting still happening with the labor union movement. We have to once again come together as people, and we're running out of time. So I just encourage every American to to hold the people accountable who are in office, hold corporations accountable, and remember that the revolution starts with ourselves at home.
And on that note, listen, Chris Smalls, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk. I really appreciate your brother. And again, thanks for sharing what happened to it. It's going to be really important.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Free Gaza, free Palestine.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.